Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top news reporters. Their questions do not necessarily reflect their point of view, but may be their way of getting a story for you. Now, here is the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. It's election time again, and our guest today is Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, whose influence in Democratic Party affairs has always been very high. In this campaign, as in others, Mrs. Roosevelt has been sharply critical of the Republican Party, but she has also raised the issue of bossism and dictatorship against the leader of her own party, the chief of Tammany, Carmine DeSapio. She has charged Mr. DeSapio with humiliating the real Democratic leaders in a successful battle in New York State to nominate Frank J. Hogan as the candidate for United States Senate. Mrs. Roosevelt is interested in another phase of this year's campaign. She is the co-chairman of the National Council for Industrial Peace, which was set up to oppose the so-called right-to-work amendments. These laws are being voted on this year in six states. They already are in force in 18 states. They are strongly resisted by organized labor. Mrs. Roosevelt remains deeply interested in foreign policy matters. Since her last visit with us on Meet the Press, she has made another trip to Russia. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Mrs. Roosevelt, are Luke P. Carroll of the New York Herald Tribune, May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald, Clifton Daniel of the New York Times, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Mrs. Roosevelt, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Mrs. Roosevelt, the Washington Post recently reported that you were so upset about Mr. DeSapio's dictation of the nomination of Mr. Hogan that you had privately told some of your friends that you might not vote for Mr. Hogan. Is there any truth in that?
No, I think that I was upset. I was upset at finding the democratic processes being flouted. And I do not like bossism, and I do not like dictatorship. I do believe, however, in the support of a party that you feel has a progressive and good record. And I feel that the Democratic Party has had a good record, both nationally and in the state.
Does that mean that you are going to support Mr. Hogan and vote the straight Democratic ticket?
I shall vote the Democratic ticket.
And support Mr. Hogan?
That I have not said.
No, that was the question, Mrs. Roosevelt.
Well, that I will not answer.
Well,
because I don't know.
Oh, well, then the rumor, then the report evidently has some basis of fact.
No, I think probably it arose from the fact that I've said what I'm saying now, that I do not know whether I will vote for Mr. Hogan or not.
Do you always vote a straight Democratic ticket, regardless of how good or bad an individual Democrat is?
I would not
is?
Vote for someone I felt was really bad. I do not feel Mr. Hogan is bad. I just feel that we could have had a better nominee who knew more about foreign policy. I do not feel that he is bad. In fact, I think in ordinary times, he would probably make a good senator.
But you are willing to say that you're going to vote for Democrats, you are going to vote for Governor Harriman, but you're not prepared to say yet that you're going to vote for Mr.
Hogan. Who else I will vote for, yes.
How important do you think the issue of Tammany Hall influence on state matters should be in this campaign?
Well, that, of course, is a local question and a state question, but I think bossism is actually an important issue.
Well, do you think that Governor Harriman has made clear that he will not be dictated by Mr. DeSapio, even though he did lose the nomination for the man
he
wanted?
I do not know, and I cannot speak for Governor Harriman, but I ought to make clear that I consider this is not just a Democratic issue, because it's just as true of the Republican Party as of the Democratic Party. Both parties are nearly always have too much influence in the politicians who are the professionals, who are the bosses.
Mrs. Roosevelt, in your long acquaintance with the Democratic Party, hasn't there been frequent instances where an individual has dictated a nomination in the same way? I'm sure you're familiar with the Secretary Burns' statement, for example, that the nomination in his time of Mr. Truman was dictated by Sidney Hillman on that. You remember this?
Yes, I don't think that is quite correct. But I'm not familiar enough with it to say that it's not true. I just don't think it's completely correct.
Mr. Carroll.
Mrs. Roosevelt, you have made some television films in support of Governor Harriman this year, have you not?
I made one, yes.
And in this one, the election of Mr. Hogan has been urged upon the people who watch that show.
Yes.
Now, is it your position, to carry this out just one step, that you have not made up your mind whether you will vote for Mr. Hogan, but you are urging others to vote for Mr. Hogan?
I did not urge Mr. Hogan's candidacy.
The television show was sponsored by the Harriman-Hogan Committee.
That's quite correct.
And the whole point of this was to garner votes.
But I did not urge his candidacy. I urged Mr. Harriman's candidacy.
And you don't feel that your participation in that show was an implied suggestion to vote for Mr. Hogan?
Not at all.
You're not prepared to urge your listeners?
But I cannot dissociate myself from the party to which I belong. Mm-hmm. And I am actively for Mr. Harriman.
But you're not prepared to urge your listeners to vote for Mr. Hogan?
No, I have explained to Mr. Spivak that I think in ordinary times, Mr. Hogan would probably be an acceptable candidate. Foreign affairs would have seemed to me much more important, and therefore I would have much preferred to have Mr. Finletter. However, I don't think Mr. Keating is very much better than Mr. Hogan.
Mrs. Craig.
Yeah, Mrs. Roosevelt, you are co-chairman, I believe, of the Committee for Industrial Peace, which opposes the right-to-work laws. You were also for many years dedicated to the Human Rights Commission on the United Nations. Don't you think it is a human right for an American worker not to join a union if he doesn't wish to?
Well, no worker is forced to join a union, Miss Craig. Simply, the right-to-work laws are a complete misnomer. They have nothing whatsoever to do with the abuses that quite often occur where power and growth of strength comes about. These have got to be corrected within the unions, and they are, I think, to a large extent, being corrected. But these laws, which are trying to curtail the rights of the unions to collective bargaining and to setting the things through collective bargaining, the rules, are an entirely different question. The aim of these laws is to really undermine the strength of the unions in getting an equality with the employer and an opportunity to improve the conditions of workers. Therefore, from my point of view, no worker is obliged to accept work under a union, to join a union, unless he wishes, unless he complies with the rules that have been laid down by collective bargaining. Now, if he doesn't want to, he can go and work somewhere else where he does not have to join a union. And I do not think that in writing the charter, and I'm very familiar with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the arguments that went on, and nothing of that kind specifically was ever brought up when it was said that no one should be forced to join an association. What they had in mind was being obliged, for instance, let's take a rather extreme case, to subscribe, under juris, to some ideas that you did not really believe in, but which would endanger you if you didn't.
But, Mrs. Roosevelt, you have always clung so to principle. And the principle, I'm asking you, do you think any American worker should have to belong to a union in order to hold his job? And under the union shop,
He doesn't have to. He can work anywhere else he wants to. But the right of collective bargaining saves the right of the worker. Therefore, there is nothing that curtails, actually, the right of the worker. If he doesn't like it, to go work somewhere else.
The catch in your answer, Mrs. Roosevelt, if I may so say so respectfully, is that he can go someplace else to work.
Yes.
But he cannot hold his job under many contracts.
No, and he should not, because if he did, Ed, he would be going against the rules which have been agreed upon between the people who have the right to bargain and the employer. Therefore, he would be weakening the very thing which gives all the workers of the country better conditions. All the workers profit by organized labor's ability to bargain and to bargain on an equality. If they do not have that, then all the workers suffer because they are the ones who have raised the standards for workers throughout the country.
In your column, Mrs. Roosevelt, in 1941, March 13, you said, "I do not believe that every man and woman should be forced to join a union."
No, I don't. I don't think you should be forced to join a union. But that means then you go work where there is no union.
Don't you think that if the unions are helpful, that everybody will belong without being compelled to?
Not in every case, because there are many people who do not know the value of the union. They have to learn first.
Mr. Daniel.
Mrs. Roosevelt, let's turn a moment to foreign policy. You've just come back from Russia for the second time, I believe, in about a year. Do you think that the Russians are, in fact, catching up with us or overtaking us in education, science, industry?
I would have to say that to compare our education, for instance, is foolish because we educate for different results. They educate from the time the child is a baby to have well-disciplined, extremely amenable citizens, and they do a very good job. We educate for people to live in the kind of society where they must be prepared to make their own decisions, where they must be prepared to think for themselves, to have initiative, to make plans, and to carry them out themselves, and incidentally, to control their representatives in a representative republic. Now, these are two totally different objectives, and to compare the education that you have is ridiculous. But I would say that the Soviet people who carry out the plans that are made for the everyday life of the people have been carefully chosen. For instance, any of you can have the opportunity of meeting the woman who is at the head of all the social services in Moscow. Her name is Madame Morybiava. I think you will look at her face and realize that she cares about people. She was very wisely chosen because people know she cares. And in that way, they have made advances with their own people. But you can't compare anything in the Soviet Union with anything over here because you have to look at it with totally different eyes.
Well, even if you can't compare it, Mrs. Roosevelt, do you think that it presents a threat to us or severe competition
to us? Oh, I think it presents a challenge to us and a challenge which we have to meet. We have to do better in all the fields. We have to put our own house in order. We have to show that as a free people, we do better than they do under juris.
Well, one further question, Mrs. Roosevelt. Do you think it's possible to meet this challenge and at the same time to live peaceably with the Russians for a considerable period?
I hope it's possible. I think they know the dangers of an atomic war as well as we do. And I think they want the world to be a going concern when they succeed, as they've made up their minds they will, by peaceful means, if they can, in making a communist world. Now, that's an enormous challenge to us, and we have to win. We just have to win.
Mr. Spivak.
Mrs. Roosevelt, Do you think it was right or wrong for the Democratic Party in New York to welcome Adam Clayton Powell back after his bolt?
I think it was
in
wrong.
In fact, to reward him by making him assistant
campaign. I think it was wrong.
When you were on this program last year, you said that you thought the National Democratic leadership had been poor. And your statement was, I've seen no real decisions as to what the Democratic Party stood for, as to where it was actually leading, and that is what I think the Democratic Party has to decide. Do you think there has been any change of importance in the Democratic Party leadership in the last year?
I think perhaps I would like to see, but it may not be possible for any party that is out of power to do. It may be an impossibility, but since the times are very serious times, I would really like to see leadership in the Democratic Party say, have a program, and say what they hoped could be accomplished both at home and abroad. It may be an impossibility because when a party is in power, it is always in the executive branch that the policies have to be laid down. It's only because the times are so serious and the hope rises in your breast that you would really see leadership coming from the party out of power on policy, even though it had to come from the legislative body. As a matter of fact, of course, the things that have been done by the president at his suggestion have had to be done with Democratic help because his own party could not have carried it. And they were done because they were things that the Democratic Party believed were good. That may be the limit to which we can go. I don't know. But I wish one could have some imagination and some intimation, at least, that new remedies had to be found or new things had to be tried to meet the problems of today.
Well, Mrs. Roosevelt, don't you agree that leadership requires leaders? Do you see those leaders in the Democratic Party today?
Oh, I see a good many leaders in the Democratic Party today. I think we have rather a wealth of leaders. I'm not at all afraid of the possible leadership if the opportunity comes.
Why aren't they leading?
Because they are not in the position and to lead at the present time. The party out of power does not lead in policy making.
Who are some of the people in the Democratic Party that you would like to see lead today?
Well, I could name a great, great many. There are an enormous number. Adlai Stevenson is a leader. Harry Truman is a leader. Hubert Humphrey is a leader. They're an enormous number. You can find them all over this country.
I'm talking about possible leaders who today will be accepted by the Democratic Party and by the people. Mr. Truman, of course, has been a leader.
I think all those I've named would be accepted by the Democratic Party and have been.
Mr. Carroll.
Mrs. Roosevelt, a Gallup poll survey just completed shows there's a great decline in prejudice in politics, and that the figures are that 68% of the people in the United States would vote for a Catholic if he were nominated by their party. Equally, these same figures show that there no longer is prejudice against a woman for president, and that a majority of the people of the United States would support a woman for president. Do you think that either of these possibilities will occur in the near future?
I doubt if they occur in the near future. I would be sorry for any woman who was nominated at the present time. Women have not held enough important positions. And the first Catholic that is elected, I hope, will be strong enough so that if a question should arise of the difference between church and state, he can really act apart from the religious basis.
You don't expect that in 1960, then, I gather.
Well, I should doubt it, but I'm no judge of that.
Do you have any long-range guess on who the nominees will be in 1960?
No, absolutely none.
Mrs. Craig.
Mrs. Roosevelt, you said in your recent book that Chiang Kai-shek had had his chance to unify China and failed. Do you see the time coming when we must recognize Red China?
Yes, under certain conditions, I think it may occur.
Two Chinas?
What?
Two Chinas, Free China and Red China?
I think it may happen that Communist China will someday have to be recognized.
Would you be willing to admit Red China to the United Nations in the one seat?
Well, technically, Miss Craig, you can't admit it
yes,
at present because they still have troops in North Korea and in North Vietnam, I think, and are at war with the United Nations. If that changes, everybody will have to rethink a new situation.
Chiang Kai-shek continues to say that he believes there will be revolt soon in Red China. Do you think that's possible?
It is very difficult under dictatorships to actually organize a revolt, and I would think that in China it would be as difficult as in the Soviet Union, though since we have no connections with China, we don't know. But I should think it would be as difficult as it is in the Soviet Union.
Mr. Daniel.
Mrs. Roosevelt, do you think, further on this question, that we should risk a war in the Taiwan Strait now or any time in the near future to protect and defend Chiang Kai-shek?
To protect and defend what?
Chiang Kai-shek.
I thought that the agreement that had just been reached was that Chiang Kai-shek was not to risk any war, or that he had agreed that he would only return to the mainland and peace by peaceful means, or naturally if there was a revolt in the mainland. I do not think that it is actually ever was a wise thing to promise military help to Chiang Kai-shek. There was a time when perhaps Formosa or Taiwan could be looked upon as a military necessity for us. Now, whether that still exists, I am no judge because I'm not a military leader. But I would like to see us avoid war if it's possible to do so.
Well, on that very subject, what do you think of the prospects for some kind of disarmament agreement with the Russians and with the Chinese?
What did you say?
What are the prospects of some kind of disarmament agreement with the Russians and perhaps with the Chinese as well?
It seems to move only by infinitesimal moves. There is some hope now in our proposal if they agree. I think they may. I think with good negotiation, you might make some moves in that direction.
Mr. Spivak.
Mrs. Roosevelt, recently in one of your columns in discussing the Chinese and the Soviet communists, you wrote, "The United States as a nation, I think, ought to face the realities of the present world situation." Why are you willing to face the realities of communism? Were you ever willing to face the realities of fascism?
Oh,
and
when
Nazism?
I speak of realities, I think we should face the fact that we know nothing about what is happening in communist China, and that from all I can learn, and I've asked people who have just come out and so forth, communist China is gaining in strength faster at percentage-wise than the Soviet Union did. Now, I think these things are necessary for us to know and to face, because it's a challenge which we have to meet.
Mrs. Roosevelt, are
the leader of the non-communist world.
I'm afraid we're going to have to keep the rest of our questions for your next appearance. I'm very sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.